Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
John Farrick, I'm about 20 years as an investigative journalist, and my first true crime book that I published came out last summer through the Kent State University Press in Ohio, which is called Bloody Lies, a CSI Scandal in the Heartland, which was about a crooked CSI director in Nebraska that was planting evidence in murder cases. But it didn't really come out until a double homicide in a farmhouse was exposed for being a wrongful arrest. And then the rest of the case kind of went in a different direction. The two real killers out of Wisconsin were identified. And that really was a fascinating story for what was my debut true crime book. So let's see. This puts us into about August or September. And I had a conversation with Steve Jackson, who's famous for writing several true crime books, including Monster, which is his first book, and then last summer's hit, which was Bogeyman. And with talking with Steve, I just kind of decided that Wild Blue Press seemed like a natural fit. They were going in a great direction and were taking on additional authors. So I decided to come on board with Wild Blue Press in the fall months. And as we were talking about things and kind of the direction of the company, kind of realized that this murder case I had covered around 2003 and 2004 when I was a reporter at the Omaha World Herald in Nebraska, really I thought would make a fascinating story. It really was an unbelievable case when I covered it. Court TV covered the trial, and there was also a story in the New York Times and the LA Times about this case. It really drew me to the case just because there's so many different and unusual facets of the small town murder case involving this woman that had been abused by her husband in the small town.
So it was with Wild Blue Press that you decided to write another book.
Correct. And again, as we were kind of toying around with different ideas for our book title and everything along those lines, it actually was my wife, Andrea, that came up with the idea of going with Dixie's Last Stand, because the book is about a woman named Dixie Shanahan. So it just really seemed that Dixie's Last Stand was a natural title. But then Steve and I had talked about the idea of a subtitle, I should say. And the question about was it murder or self-defense really seemed to be a great idea on Steve's part. And that's really what I want readers to take away from the book. It's a story that they can and should make up their own minds as far as whether or not this was a justifiable homicide or whether this was just outright cold-blooded, calculated murder committed by this woman that had tried in the past to escape this domestic violence, but for whatever reason, for various reasons, would always come back to her husband and come back to the house and stay and live with him, regardless of the abuse.
Yes, I think for those of us who have not been in an abusive relationship, it must be difficult to understand that relationship, how it continues on despite the horrible actions of the abuser. Can we go back and set up the scene? Who is Dixie?
Dixie Shanahan, in her mid-30s at the time that this all went down, Aaron, and she lived in a very small town of about 350 people, and she was married to a fellow named Scott Shanahan. And Scott had pretty much lived in this town of Defiance, Iowa, which is in far western Iowa. Had pretty much lived there his whole life. Dixie moved in with him and his family when she was a teenager. She was dating Scott at the time and got along real well with her, I should say with his parents. So it seemed to work out okay, the dating and living there. But over time, the situation really worsened for her. It became a very abusive relationship, but it started, Aaron, first with verbal abuse and threats and throwing stuff at her. Over time, though, it gets a lot worse, and it becomes very physically violent, where she's beaten, thrown downstairs, choked, tied up in her basement and kind of left there for a couple days. The situation just really was it was a terrible situation to begin with. And, over time, eventually, fortunately, I should say, too, local law enforcement becomes involved in the case, and they haul Scott Shanahan away on a couple of occasions and arrest him for domestic violence. This seems to at least help Dixie out as far as she's able to escape the torment and the abuse for a while at least. But Scott's in jail for only a few days in both of these situations. He comes back. She decides that she really wants him back in her life. He apologizes, promises to make amends, that he's going to be a better man, better husband. And she falls for this, and wants to believe that it's going to be true. And again, just over time, things just continually, gradually worsen, and Dixie's kind of in the situation where she determines, in her own mind, that really the only way out for her is to take her husband's life, and that's what she's ultimately going to decide to do, Aaron.
Now, they have children together. Is there much known about their children? When I read the story, it seemed as though the children may not have been high up on his priority list, but they seemed to be high on hers.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. They were very young at the time. I'm trying to go back in memory here. I think there would have been around 7. The oldest boy would have been 7 or 8. There would have been a girl. There would have been about 4 or 5. And they had just conceived another child shortly before Scott was killed. Dixie really cared about her kids a lot. And she really nurtured them and loved them. And it just seemed like Scott really was not very interested in being a dad. He just really loved tinkering with his automobiles and fixing up farm tractors. He had a shop across the street from his house, where he pretty much putzed around and hung out there all day long. Didn't have a job, really didn't do anything at all. And this was pretty much where he hung out when he wasn't sleeping in till noon, pretty much every day. But you're right, he really didn't seem to show much love toward his kids, and it would come out in the course of the trial and the police investigation that on different occasions that he had threatened his wife, on various instances where he found out that she was pregnant. And that becomes part of the story, part of the whole, belief or defense, I should say, on her part that, that he was threatening to harm her because she was pregnant with a third child at the time that that this all transpired in pretty much at the end of August of 2003.
So in this town, he's not very well liked. People have a sense that he is a no good bum and that he's an abuser and they don't have much use for him. And in fact, when he comes up missing, there aren't too many people who are concerned about his being gone.
Correct. And you know, and part of it is probably along the lines that people, a lot of people probably didn't know he was gone because they didn't pay attention to him anyway. It was a sleepy little town, like I said, about 350 people or so. But a lot of those people worked, you know, 10 miles down the road in Harlan, Iowa, or another 10 minutes up the road in Denison, Iowa. And there really weren't too many jobs, you know, or major employers around Defiance, Iowa. You know, about the only thing there really was the volunteer fire station, the town bank, a little restaurant slash bar that was on the edge of town, and, you know, in City Hall. So there really weren't too many places for people to meander and just kind of mill around and stuff like that, Aaron. So, yeah, when he turns up missing, nobody really knows he's missing, frankly, because his truck is still sitting in the driveway. And but over time, though, people start to notice, or at least a few people start to notice. And it's really not until a full year after he had been missing that somebody, and I don't know who it is, the person's name was never revealed. And when I talked to the sheriff when I was putting together the book, he didn't even remember who it was. But nonetheless, some anonymous call was placed to the sheriff's office, the Shelby County Sheriff in Harlan, Iowa. And the person just said, hey, you might want to start looking around for Scott Shanahan, more or less. You know, we haven't seen him around town for about a year or so. And, you know, Scott would have been about 40 years old at the time. And it wouldn't have been uncharacteristic for a guy like that to decide to up and leave his wife and, you know, start a new life somewhere else. But to the sheriff's credit and his agency's credit, you know, they took the anonymous call seriously and kind of did their own research and their own digging as far as what the facts were, you know, regarding this mysterious disappearance of a guy who was 40 years old, kind of a homebody and a jerk, but, you know, but nonetheless, you know, wasn't being seen or spotted anywhere in town, and yet his pickup truck is still sitting in his driveway.
Well, she's able to dismiss most people's concerns, anyone who was concerned, by stating that Scott had run off with another woman and that he was about 45, 50 minutes away. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that was the the initial story, and it kind of changed a little bit, deviated a little bit as far as what town. But yeah, the basic story that she gave first was that he had run off and ended up in Atlantic, Iowa, which is a town, I think, of about 7,000 or so, about 40, 45 minutes away in Cass County, Iowa. And the sheriff of Shelby County, to his credit, starts doing some digging over there. He gets a hold of the sheriff's office over there and the police department in that town, and they start doing some background and trying to figure out if by chance Scott Shanahan's living over around Atlantic, Iowa. They can't find any record at all of any mail being delivered over there. The cops, you know, check their records, and they've had no incident reports, no arrest reports involving Scott Shanahan. And there's just no trail. There's no paper trail, or just no sign at all that Scott Shanahan had ever moved from his house in Defiance, which he had inherited from his mom and his stepdad, to somehow supposedly ended up somewhere else in Iowa. So things were not coming together as far as Dixie's story and claim that that her husband had up and left her and you know, was over in one of the neighboring towns, Aaron.
Maybe it's just because, reading your book, you actually lay out that he does have perhaps a friend or two. I did get the sense that perhaps one of those friends called on his behalf because they were concerned about him.
That's a possibility, now that you mention that. Yeah, he did have a couple friends. I'm trying to remember. I know there was one that might have been a cousin, but there was also a couple people that he either had known from just fixing up, you know, and doing repairs on auto parts and restoring vehicles. But nonetheless, you're right, there were a few friends that he did have that it's quite possible that one of them could have been the person that called up the sheriff. I know that they were interviewed by the sheriff in the aftermath of the investigation, and their statements were very helpful to him at the time that they were when they were trying to figure out what else to do, you know, and the decision's ultimately going to be made to go back to Scott's house and see what's over there, if anything. So, yeah, that's true.
There were also people who had come across perhaps signs that something was amiss? Wasn't there a meter reader that had noticed something over time?
Yeah, that's one of the that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, Aaron. Yeah, the meter reader, I always thought was kind of a fascinating little part of the case. It just kind of shows you just the importance of some really small details. So the fellow was going around in the previous winter, the winter of 2002, and he goes around the town again, you know, about 100 properties. He gets through the houses in about an hour, a few hours, I should say. When he's walking through the backyard of the Shanahan home, he notices that the window in the back bedroom is wide open in the middle of the winter. And he notices the following month when he's back in January, it's the same deal. This window is still wide open. Same was true with February. And it just didn't seem, I mean, none of that made sense. You're talking about the middle of an Iowa winter. There's plenty of snow on the ground. There's plenty of days when it's 5, 10, below zero. And yet this window is still sitting wide open the whole winter long. So when the investigation is moving forward, he becomes, you know, a small but very important figure in kind of showing, that quite possibly, this may be a spot in the house for the law enforcement officials to investigate once they would finally get inside the property, Aaron.
Well, and it doesn't seem like that actually is what happens. I know it seems like it should be, but I don't think anyone was prepared to see what they saw when they actually used a search warrant and arrived at the property to search the house.
I remember when I was putting together the book, I did some of the interviews with the sheriff and the deputy sheriff. And I just remember talking with Mark Hervey, who's now the current sheriff, but he was the number two guy when Gene Kavanaugh was the sheriff. And they were huddling together beforehand, strategizing as far as about where in the world Scott Shanahan could be. And I remember Mark told me, he kind of chuckled when he said this, but he said he's in the northeast bedroom. And the sheriff and another DCI agent that were in the room, Dave Jobes was his name, but they both kind of looked at him and chuckled. Hervey was half serious when he said that, but I remember when I talked to him afterwards, just in his mind, that was, the logical spot, and about the only, spot that seemed, to kind of jump out at him that would make sense as far as where Scott Shanahan could be. Nonetheless, none of the law enforcement officials, when they went into the house, were prepared and expected, what they were going to find that day. They figured maybe he was going to be buried somewhere in the yard if he was there. And the sheriff kind of thought that she had probably gotten rid of him, by now. It would have been, 14, 15 months now after the fact. So a lot of time had passed already. But nonetheless, when the crime lab people start to go through the house, that back bedroom door is just kind of barricaded. There's a bunch of boxes and other kids' clutter and toys. They're just kind of propped up against the door in the hallway, I should say. But when they tried to open the door through the bedroom, that door was locked. And the same was true with the door that led from the bathroom into the bedroom, the second door. There was a chest of drawers that was placed up against that door. Nonetheless, they're finally able to open the door. One of the investigators had a penknife that he was able to get that door open. So they open the door, and the first thing that they notice isn't the sight, but it's the smell. They're just overcome by the whiff, of just the horror, the horrible stench, of this dead body that had been rotting in this bedroom for 14 months now. I could just imagine, how bad that must have smelled. But the rest of the house, though, and this is important for listeners, the rest of the house, you couldn't smell anything. Again, because these two doors were closed shut, and Dixie had also placed different items around the bedroom door, including a couple air fresheners and a large towel. So basically that shielded the smell from getting into the rest of the house and percolating through the, you know, the rest of the property and stuff like that. But yeah, it really was something else, and it was amazing. And you know, they were just shocked, you know, to find what they found that Monday afternoon on October 20th of 2003.
So at this point, it's pretty obvious she knows at least that he's died, and that she's somehow just shielded him off from the rest of the house.
She obviously knew what had happened to him, since she was responsible, you know, for his demise. But after he died, you know, what happens is she just kind of does this out of sight, out of mind deal, you know, where she takes all those precautions that I talked about a few minutes ago, you know, placing the towels under the door, going out and getting a couple air fresheners to place strategically, you know, in different spots in the hallway to kind of mask any smell that could potentially get into the other parts of the hallway. You know, and then again, move the chest of drawers to block, or I should say barricade the bedroom from the bathroom. So basically, it's her then at that point in time then. It's only Dixie Shanahan and her two children, ages 4 and 7 approximately, and this unborn child that she was, you know, bearing in her womb at the time as well. But it was just, you know, that's all that was left in the house at that point in time, along with her dead husband, you know, who was, you know, left in the bed, you know, the master bedroom where Dixie and Scott had normally slept. She cordoned off that room and just kind of left him in there for days, you know, which turned into weeks, which turned into months, and, you know, in past, it was longer than a year, you know, 14 months to be exact, you know, how long he was left in that bedroom.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
And of course, one of the reasons we know that the house, the rest of the house, didn't smell bad was because her boyfriend was there and he never seemed bothered by any odor.
Yeah, that was another strange part of the case. There's no facts or no evidence at all that shows that somehow he was in on the deal, or that, you know, the backstory. I should back up a little bit on that. Dixie meets him. His name was Jeff, but she meets him on Memorial Day weekend of 2003. It was at a neighborhood barbecue at one of the houses a few doors down. And she and this guy who lived about – he lived at least a half an hour away in a town called Ida Grove, Iowa. But they hit it off real well, to the point where he's going to wind up staying inside Dixie's house pretty much every weekend nonstop from Memorial Day weekend – well, after that weekend, but pretty much from June, July, August, September, and until the middle of October. till the police go in the house and do the search warrant. He testifies at a later point in time and talks to the cops because obviously they're curious, you know, and wondering, you know, how in the heck he didn't notice, you know, Dixie's dead husband in the other bedroom. But he just maintained that he never went in that room and that he just presumed that knowing Dixie's husband, that there must have been a lot of abuse, horrific abuse that had taken place in that room, and that's why you know, Dixie always kept the doors closed in that back bedroom. He slept with her in just one of the other rooms of the house, but again, he never went inside that room, and you know, I can only imagine what his reaction was you know, after law enforcement went into the house and found the body, you know, and hauled away his girlfriend and charged her with murder.
So one of the difficult things with Justin being gone is normally we do our promotional stuff, like for our sponsor.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. Because you guys have Audible books now, right?
Right. We have Audible is sponsoring this episode.
Oh, awesome.
So Audible.com, they're sponsoring us, and they have over 150,000 titles. I don't listen to audiobooks typically because I'm such a big reader.
Same here.
I know they have classics on there. They have Dracula on an audiobook, and it's fully dramatized, and it's supposed to be pretty impressive, and that's the kind of thing that would get me to listen to an audiobook, because I really enjoy listening to old-time radio shows.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you think back to, like, the War of the Worlds.
Right, yeah, with Orson Welles.
Orson Welles.
Yeah.
And I love having a cast. We can give out a free audiobook for someone to try, and all they have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/generationY. And it's GENERATIONWHY. And they go there and they sign up for a 30-day trial, and you get a free audiobook from them that you can take anywhere you go.
Yeah, no, that's for sure.
At this point, the investigators have to sort out exactly how this happened. And I noticed from the story that one of the issues that comes up and sort of stays with the case throughout is a question of when did this go down? Because it's difficult to take her at her word.
I agree, Aaron. And, you know, and that was one thing that I was thinking about a lot as I was, you know, kind of reflecting on the case since I had covered this, you know, many years ago. But just somehow the premise or taking her word, you know, that, you know, that the crime happened or that the shooting happened the way that it did, is something that you have to be skeptical on. And nonetheless, it did seem logical. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head why. But there was they were able to at least pinpoint, because of the I think he had gone to an eye doctor to get some glasses. So he was at least in town in Harlan, Iowa, those last couple days in August of 2002. So the thinking is that was pretty much the last time anybody ever saw him alive. So he was pretty much, he had to be killed at the end of August of 2002. But again, whether or not he died on August 30th or September 1st is probably, you know, nobody really knows for sure, you know, but nonetheless, I do think that the fact that Dixie decided to say that she shot him on August 30th, that's going to come back to bite her at a later point in time when she goes to takes her case to the trial, Aaron. So let's see. So you get to the point where once the body is found in the bedroom, she's immediately arrested that day and charged with murder. The town really rallies around her, and they put together the bail money, I think the 10% that was needed, and bail her out of jail while she's awaiting these murder charges. It's one of the situations where the small town prosecutor had to bow out of the case because he had represented her husband as a criminal defense attorney years earlier. So you get the state of Iowa, and they send in one of their best prosecutors, a guy named Chuck Thoman, a very experienced and you know, top-notch prosecutor who had really been around the block and prosecuted a lot of murder cases around Iowa. He weighs the evidence and really decides that he has a strong case to prove that this was not domestic violence, but this really was a cold-blooded murder that happened, you know, while D- Dixie's husband was probably asleep at the time that he was shot and killed. And that's going to be the case that he's going to eventually move ahead with when we get to the stage of the trial then, Aaron. A lot of people, again, around town were really rallied to her defense, and they did not want to see her prosecuted. But other people really just kind of had an open mind, really didn't know what to believe for sure. And that's kind of what the prosecutor was aiming for. You know, once they got to the point of selecting a jury and trying to find people that could be fair and impartial to serve on the jury.
Do you feel like they were able to do that, to get people who were fair? Because sometimes it comes up in cases where there's a question, and I know there's actually a process by which jurors are accepted, but was there any sense that they had, that they were able to get jurors that were fair here?
Yeah, I was surprised that they did, and I don't think it took them incredibly long to come up with a jury. Obviously, everybody in that town had read about the case or seen it on TV. Some people had interactions with either the defendant, Dixie Shanahan, or her husband, Scott Shanahan. But nonetheless, you know, in a county of 13,000 or so, they were able to pick a jury and find 12 people and a couple alternates that were willing to put aside everything that they had seen or read about the case in the news media and the newspaper, and promised to deliver, you know, a righteous and fair verdict. You know, one thing too, though, that's important to point out for listeners, though, because in a lot of cases, as you know, it's about guilt or innocence, kind of the who did it. You know, is my client guilty? Dixie and her lawyer put on a defense of justification. So she conceded that she did kill her husband. Okay, and that's an important distinction because, you know, in this case, the jury wasn't going to decide whether or not she did it, but whether or not she was in the right or in the wrong, you know, to kill her husband as she did. So the defense was a self-defense, you know, argument is what she was going to put forth. And meanwhile, the prosecutor, Charlie Thoman, for the state of Iowa, argued that this was a, you know, cold-blooded, calculated murder by a woman that, you know, clearly had been a victim of domestic violence in her past. There was no doubt about that, as he acknowledged and pointed out to the jury. But his point, Aaron, was that this did not excuse her behavior, you know, and more or less the evidence was going to show when the case got to the jury that that she didn't kill her husband during some quarrel or struggle or violent, you know, fist fight between the two of them, but rather she probably shot him while he was asleep, either at night or still in the early, you know, early in the morning. But nonetheless, she would have walked up to him with one of his shotguns, aimed it at the back of his head, fired the trigger, you know, and he died in his sleep instantaneously. So that was the case that was going to be argued, you know, before the jury of 12 fair-minded citizens of Shelby County, Iowa then.
She had a way out, though, and she didn't take it. This is a trial that she's going into where the evidence seems to support that she essentially ambushes him. And it's understandable that prior abuse factors in, but she still ambushed him. Do you believe that she goes in with this mindset that she's not guilty, or that she's justified, or that the jury will see it that way because she doesn't take the easy way out?
Yeah, I think that it's kind of all three. Aaron, all three of those scenarios you brought up, I think, and she convinced herself that whatever she did was right, but I also think that she felt that that the jury, whoever was picked on the jury, was going to vote in her favor. I just think that she was just 100% convinced of that, and just totally ruled out the possibility that the evidence would prove otherwise. And again, the stories had been in the media so far up to that point had been very sympathetic toward her. She just kind of, I think, presumed that that everybody was supporting her. But that wasn't necessarily going to be the way it was going to go, though, once we got into the jury trial and the jurors were going to look at the evidence and then make a determination whether or not this justified, you know, self-defense, or whether this really was, you know, an act of brutal and vicious murder So, yeah, I just think she played her cards wrong. And I could go into this, too, if you want, Aaron, but there was also that opportunity, you know, where the judge and the prosecutor, you know, had given her an opportunity before the trial to take a plea bargain where she could have pleaded guilty to a lesser degree offense and only had to serve, you know, somewhere between, you know, 2.5 to 5 years. Clearly, the maximum she would have served was 10 years, but in all likelihood, she would have only had to serve about 2.5 to 5 years of time. But nonetheless, she just totally rejected her defense attorney when he presented her with that. So again, in my mind, that convinces me, and you know, looking back on the case, that she just absolutely believed that she was going to be found not guilty, and people were going to take her at her word. And you know, once she got on the witness stand and told her version of what she claimed was what happened.
How does this work out for Dixie? She's going in as an abused woman who's accused, and she admits to killing him. So how does this work out for her in this trial?
This was one of the most fascinating, you know, trials that I've ever covered as a journalist, and I've covered, you know, a fair number in different states. But, you know, really, once she got on the witness stand, that was kind of where everybody just, you know, reporters and people in the audience and the gallery and even the jurors just, you know, really focused in on every word that was coming out of her mouth and also the questions that were being asked by her lawyer and eventually the prosecutor when he got his chance on cross-examination. So, you know, the other witnesses were important, but you know, really this was going to boil down to whether or not Dixie Shanahan was believable, incredible on the witness stand or not. So when she gets her chance to tell her story, you know, basically I'll cut to the chase. The story really is along the lines of that, you know, she got up early in the morning, got one of her kids ready for school, and Scott wakes up, you know, or kind of rolls around in bed and doesn't get up in time to say goodbye to his son. And proceeds to get out of bed and then just totally goes berserk, you know, and just starts beating the crap out of her again and takes her into the garage and starts pummeling her, you know, around there. And eventually she gets back into the living room, you know, and the story is that he's going to grab a couple of the telephones and take them and hide them in the bedroom with him, you know, make a comment, or I shouldn't say a comment, just yell at her and say this day is not over with, threaten that he's going to kill her sooner or later that day. So if you take that at face value and take her at her word at that, then kind of what happens next is really kind of unbelievable and really seems like it's a stretch. Her story that she's going to tell the jury is that she decided now, kind of once and for all, that she was going to go get those phones, call law enforcement, call 911, and report him for domestic violence at that point in time. Now, obviously, if that, you know, she had a million other options if that was true, including running out the door and going to one of her friends and having them, you know, call rather than going back into the bedroom, confront her abusive and angry husband, you know, and taking her chances then. But her story is she goes, she scampers down the hallway, goes back to the bedroom, and then as she's trying to go for the phones, notices there's a shotgun propped up next to the bed, and that he's going to roll over and turn over toward her, and she's going to just grab that shotgun and fire it at his head and shoot him in self-defense. The problem with that story, though, is that once the prosecutor gets his opportunity on cross-examination, though, Aaron, it's clear that the shotgun blast wasn't to the front of Scott Shanahan. It was to the back of Scott Shanahan. It was a shotgun shell through the back of his skull. That just really seemed to kind of blow the lid off of the theory that somehow she killed him during a violent confrontation. Furthermore, this was really important, I thought. Again, a small detail, but it really was telling and I think kind of set the tone and the course for the case when it went to the jury. But the two shotgun shells that were loaded inside that weapon were not the correct ammunition for that weapon. I think that was a 16-gauge shotgun, and I think there was a 20-gauge round that had been fired into the back of his skull, and there was a 12-gauge round that was still jammed into the shotgun. The significance of that is that Scott Shanahan had handled weapons and shotguns his whole life. He's not the kind of guy that's going to mess up and put the incorrect ammunition into his own shotgun. So the prosecution was able to proof and, you know, and show the jury that, that the only person that really wouldn't know how to handle a shotgun and know how to load a shotgun properly was his wife, Dixie. And so I thought that was another key, very important small detail that really helped bury her when the case would go to the jury.
Yeah, there's no question if they were wondering if this was premeditated or not. She went and loaded that shotgun improperly. That, to me, was very convincing. That said, there's this question of she's an abused woman. She can get the authorities to come and get him, to take him away. But he's not permanently gone. How long can they really take him away for? Is this a woman who is justified somewhat in that he was always going to show back up? He was always going to beat her and abuse her?
Well, the one thing that I fall back to, though, too, is that it was just about less than, 2000 and 2001 was really when the law enforcement authorities had taken him away for his third domestic violence arrest in just a matter of a couple years, okay? And it was during that arrest that he was charged with a felony and faced approximately 5 years in prison. And the prosecutor at that point in time, along with the sheriff's office, really was enthused and working hard toward building a strong case. They wanted to get Scott Shanahan prosecuted and convicted because they thought that that would send him away to prison, and that would give Dixie more than ample time to get out of that relationship, and sever ways with Scott, get a divorce. She had family in Texas, you know, which is where she retreated to and went down to, you know, immediately after his arrest for this felony domestic violence. Okay, but it's while she was down in Texas, though, is when she has this change of heart, though, and that's when she decides she's not going to participate in any prosecution of her husband, and she's just going to flat out refuse to come back and testify against him. So the prosecutor is going to be left with having to drop the charges since this witness won't testify at the trial. So there was this golden opportunity there, Aaron, you know, for Dixie to put him away, you know, where he belonged, which was in prison for a long period of time. And, you know, and when it really mattered, she decided that she, wasn't going to help the prosecution. She could have stayed in Texas, which is pretty darn far away from Iowa, the state of Iowa. But she's going to choose to move back to Iowa after the charges are dropped against him. And she's never going to notify law enforcement ever again, 2001 or 2002, about any suspected domestic violence that may be happening at that house. And there's no doubt that there was. So in a lot of ways, I kind of go back to the fact that every time law enforcement is notified in this case, Aaron, you know, of some domestic violence or abuse involving Scott Shanahan, it seemed to me that they stepped up and answered the call and made an arrest and put the case in the criminal justice system. Again, there were plenty of opportunities there that nobody notified law enforcement of any follow-up abuse that may be going on. And it spiraled into the situation where Dixie's going to ultimately decide to kill her husband.
You think this is a situation, I know this is just opinion, but mm-hmm. a situation in which she started working up the nerve to eliminate him from her life permanently? Or do you think that when she went back, that she really was trying to give him another chance? And since he squandered that opportunity, she just became enraged over time, and this is the culmination of that rage.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince, Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
I think that the first possibility could be true, that she just kind of built up the rage, or just kind of enough is enough, and decided, you know, I'm going to, end this situation once and for all. I think that's a possibility. I'm not convinced because I wasn't there and don't know what was going through her head. But the prosecutor is going to make the argument, and it's a pretty well laid out argument that, you know, Scott's mom and stepdad were, you know, had decent money. And so when Scott's parents pass away, he inherits that house, which had it's a 2-acre property, you know, a nice property, nice house, 2 acres of land in the middle of town, you know, but he also inherits about $177,000, you know, in the mid 1990s. So he inherits, $177,000, and in a mutual fund. And basically, by the time that by the summer of 2002, that fund is down to zero. There's no money left in that thing, and it's right around that point in time, you know, where when the money's run out, that's when this killing happened. And that's the prosecutor's argument, is that Dixie was able to put up with any abuse beforehand, as long as the money was good. But once the money ran out, she had no use for Scott Shanahan. Again, I don't know, you know, if that absolutely is what happened and that's what snowballed and caused her to kill. But I think that's a strong possibility. And, you know, and I can't dismiss that. It just seems that she decides, you know, that enough is enough, and she's going to end this relationship and, you know, end it in the way that she did. You know, and the thing is that if this truly was a, you know, a domestic violence situation at that moment in time, I should say, and she called law enforcement and told them, you know, and cried, or, you know, just was emotional and just explained to them honestly, truthfully, what had happened. If it had been truly a domestic violence situation where she killed him, I think law enforcement probably would have gone pretty easy on her, since they knew her real well and they knew Scott real well, and it would have made sense. But the fact that she gets interviewed numerous times, Aaron, numerous times before they actually go in that house and find the body, you know, and she just tells them just a web of lies over and over about Scott went to Atlantic, Iowa. Oh, maybe he's in Avoca, Iowa. Oh, he ran off with some blonde woman and came back one time to pick up some CDs and a change of clothes, you know. And even on the day that they searched the house, you know, they asked her earlier that morning. It was kind of the last hurrah for her. But the sheriff sat down with her, and so did the DCI agent, Dave Jobes. And they ask her, you know, one final time, you know, about Scott, and she still clings to that story that he ran off and left her, you know, and the kids. So she was going to stick with that story, you know, literally until they found the body. And when the sheriff shows up later that afternoon to, you know, to come look for her, you know, the first thing she tells the lady at the farm was, you know, that they're coming to arrest her. So she kind of knew where things were going, I think, and it's probably because she knew that this was a premeditated killing that she committed.
Well, I don't want to go too much into where this case stands, because people can always pick up the book and find out what's going on with her case, because it certainly gets even more interesting. But I would like to go over the fact that both law enforcement as well as the judge, and I would even venture to say the prosecution, they cared about her. This wasn't just a person to send through the system or to get a victory against. Didn't you get the sense that this was the case, that it wasn't just simply, well, you're a bad person, we're going to prosecute the heck out of you? That this was, even the judge spoke to her and expressed that he wished that there was something he could do.
Yeah, I think that they really did, Aaron, feel sorry for her, that the case and her life turned out the way that it did, as far as, where she's on trial, you know, for murder, when they really knew that people saw her as an abused woman. And, you know, even at the point of sentencing, you know, the judge makes comments along those lines. And the sheriff also kind of felt bad for her. But again, they point out that she made these choices. And it was these choices that kind of led her to the situation where she was charged with murder, goes on trial for murder. And, you know, eventually the jury makes its decision in the case, too. But you're right. She was not somebody that people were just trying to put through the system or, you know, or look at her as, you know, a victory for the prosecution. You know, nobody wanted the case to turn out the way that it did. But yet, you know, really, when it's all said and done, the facts of the case really showed that, you know, the verdict that was turned in was probably the most appropriate verdict that should have been returned by the jury, given what the evidence, what the physical evidence showed, and given what her story was when she testified in her own defense. The two collided with each other, and you're either going to believe that you know that her version, no matter what it is, you know, she should be found not guilty just based on the fact that she had lived and endured all these years of abuse, or you're going to look at the case and say that may be true, but in this instant here, you know, were the facts really that this was a killing during in the midst of a domestic violence dispute, or was this really a woman that was planning things out and kill her husband, you know, while he was asleep, then decided just to kind of close off this memory, you know, just kind of lock it away in the back bedroom and leave it there, you know, for months upon months, you know, and over a year. So, yeah, it really was something else, that's for sure.
Well, it's recommended if anyone would like to know more about where this case goes, because there is more to the story after the point at which we spoke to that his book, Dixie's Last Stand, goes through those details. And like I said, they're pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting, again, how everybody really feels for her despite the job they have to do. They feel for this woman. And so I encourage you to read the story if you want to get the entire story. And there is that debate as you read it or as you look into the story more, you'll start to question, did they get it right? Or does she have a case here, even if she was not very good at expressing it?
Yeah, no, thanks, Aaron. I really appreciate positive recommendation. You guys are great and you have a terrific show. And I really tried to write this book. It's a little bit shorter, obviously, than Bloody Lies, but on the same token too, I wanted it to be a quick read for people, because I really also wanted people to kind of look back after you read the book and kind of think about different aspects of the case, you know, and what would you have done if you were in Dixie's shoes? You know, what would you have done if you were the sheriff of Shelby County, Iowa? You know, and you get that 911 call or whatever that was, you know, saying Scott Shanahan's been missing for a year. How would you handle that? What about if you're the prosecutor, Charlie Thelman, you know, and you find out after the fact there's been an arrest made, you don't know anything at all about who Dixie Shanahan is, you don't know who Scott Shanahan is, but yeah, it's your job to represent the state of Iowa, you know, and the local sheriff had just made an arrest, and you got to sift through the facts and weigh the evidence and figure out what kind of case you have to bring to a jury. So, you know, about the only person in the case that really his hands were tied, and, you know, again, I'll let people read the book to find that, you know, kind of find out why, but it's really the judge. The judge is really the only one that really can't, you know, say or do anything, you know, when it really matters in this case. And that's unfortunate, but again, that's, you know, that's a big part of this whole story in this case as well then, Aaron. Like I said, I really appreciate, you know, everybody that's read the book. There's been a lot of opinions, people that have read the book and some, you know, really feel sympathy for Dixie. And I'm totally, you know, in agreement, you know, totally understand where they're coming from. And I've also seen a lot of people that have read the book and gone on Amazon and said, you know, no, the case turned out the way that it should have and stuff like that. So that kind of tells me, you know, that, you know, everybody's got their own opinion and people will read this book and, you know, draw their own conclusions. And frankly, that's what I was hoping for.
Yes, the case that causes debate or lots of conversation, that's a story that sticks around.
Time will tell, but yeah, the last chapter on Dixie Shanahan hasn't been written possibly, so, you know, time will tell. You know, there may be a reason to do an update on this book or do a blog post or, you know, or something, but, you know, but there still may come a point in time where there's still more information, a key turn of event that'll change kind of the, you know, situation that she's in right now then, Aaron?
My firm belief is you'll have to do an update. that's from reading the story and knowing what's going on.
And I'm sure that I would, you know, again, whether that'll be a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, who knows? But, you know, there's still a chance that at some point in time, things will change as far as for her, you know, for her future and stuff like that, you know. And if it does, then, you know, I'll be ready to write that story or update the book, you know, accordingly.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming on, John. I know we first spoke back when because you contacted me. And that first book you wrote, definitely recommend that again to listeners, Bloody Lies. I think it was one of the best books I read that year. And different cases, but still cases that cause a lot of conversation. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, no, thanks, Aaron. And, you know, if it's okay, just to mention quickly, this next book that I'm working on right now, which is, again, going to be a true crime feature for Steve Jackson and Wild Blue Press, but I'm hoping to have that done within the next 2 months or so. But it's kind of actually a sequel to Bloody Lies. The last few pages of Bloody Lies, I get into another unbelievable, sensational murder case that had happened in Omaha, Nebraska, right around the time that the Stocks were murdered in Murdoch, Nebraska. And there was a question on this case, still to this day, about whether Dave Kofod, you know, the crooked CSI director, had also planted blood evidence in this other case. So I've been, you know, spending a lot of time now kind of doing my research on that, and my hope is to have that, you know, ready as a follow-up book here in the next couple months or so.
Very good. At Wild Blue Press.
Yes, and again, people, if they're interested with Dixie, you know, just go to wildbluepress.com and, you know, /Dixie, and like I said, it's available on Amazon right now, and actually, within the next few weeks or so, you know, I've been assured that we'll actually have the paperback version of Dixie out. I know there's still a lot of people that, you know, that read paperback and, you know, haven't gotten the Kindle version and stuff, and that's fine. So we'll have that hopefully available here within a few weeks or so, and, you know, I'll be anxious to see how that version looks again then. Thanks again, Aaron, for the opportunity to be on, you know, Generation Y podcast. You guys are doing excellent work, and your shows are just phenomenal. And last week's episode on D.B. Cooper was great, so I would encourage people, if they haven't listened to that, to go back and listen to that story as well. It was a great job.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries, and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.